Hey, everybody, welcome back to Cold Case Murder Mysteries. I'm your host, Ryan Krause, and we're about to descend into the madness that is Ed Gein's adulthood, picking up where we left off in the years following his mother's death, in which his steady decline led him to committing murder. Now, we ended the last episode with Ed locked away inside his home, surrounded by filth and piles of junk, and with the windows covered so that no light got in, leaving the place a far cry from the immaculate farmhouse his mother kept until the mid-1940s. When health issues and ultimately death gave way to Ed's increasing isolation, his mental health consistently deteriorated along with the home in seemingly perfect symbiosis. The more Ed came apart inside his head, the more evident it became within his home. And so, while Eddie Gein continued to have a few visitors here and there until the early 1950s, the macabre environment within the home eventually precluded having company in order to keep the secrets. Rumors had started to swirl about the odd little man, but beyond that, what was worse is that the local children began to consider the home haunted. That rumor evolved into one where Eddie's dead mother, Augusta, appeared as a terrifying ghostly apparition and could be seen outside late at night protecting the home, warding off the curious intruders. One young neighbor spoke of the necessity of having to pass the farmhouse every day when returning from school, and how he would sprint past it each time, yet he suggested it wasn't Ed Gein that scared him at all. It was the house. Something was wrong with that place. Something evil. But like I said, the house was always the metaphorical projection of Eddie's mind that was haunted by his mother, who refused him outside relationships as a kid. So the local children naturally made it a place that was supposedly haunted by the ghost of Eddie's mom, trying to keep them out, because that is exactly what was going on inside his head and in his childhood. The place really was haunted by Augusta. The issue is emotional stagnancy or unwillingness to move forward, something that began in Eddie's childhood when his mother stunted his emotional growth and left him stuck in that place, waiting, and so it manifests in the young neighbor's story by projecting his willingness to move forward in the manifested symbolic imagery of running. He sees the stagnancy projected from Ed's mind in the form of the spooky, decrepit home coming apart and utilizes the symbolic imagery of a child moving forward very quickly away from that house, refusing that fate. So as we talked about in the last episode, Eddie got up and left his home upon having an epiphany that he needed to kill the bartender, Mary Hogan, who reminded him so much of Mother when he sat for a beer at her tavern. She was so much like Mother, strong, stern, a self-assured businesswoman. But there was one difference. Mary Hogan spoke of sinful things, like drinking, of course, and entertaining men. But most of all, what scared Eddie is that she talked about sex, and it made him think things about what he wanted to do to her. But that's when Mother's voice would overcome his own, like Norman Bates, and berate him for having such filthy, unacceptable thoughts. She didn't raise a boy who thinks of such things. But with Eddie thinking of them now, slipping into more frequent sexual fantasies as he made his way into Mary Hogan's establishment on a regular basis, he knew what needed to be done. He couldn't possibly drown his mother's domineering voice in alcohol, not even inside his head, which was a painful, hard lesson that his long-suffering father endured until he finally broke. Eddie would do what she wanted. He would wash Mary Hogan clean of her sin. Now, if you're Mary and want to do that emotionally, meaning cleanse yourself of sin, What you do is symbolically shed your outer skin or ego to reveal the authentic self waiting to be realized beneath, having risen from the ignorant or unrealized darkness of the unconscious mind. But if Eddie, using sociopathy, wants to do it for her, he has no access to her emotional world and therefore can only have autonomy over her body and physicality. So, if you wanted to make an emotional change, your unrealized self would rise into your conscious, rational mind in the light, so to speak, where you could then prepare for the manifestation or process of making thoughts transcend to physical reality by way of action. Part of that process would be to identify what's holding you back from becoming the thing you want to be. The idea is that inside us, emotionally, we are always creating a cocoon or womb in which we will change in darkness before realizing that new identity in the conscious mind when it rises into the light through the subconscious. When realized, ironically, we become afraid of the change and seek to remain in the comfort of that womb as our old self. But the backbone of the hero's journey is understanding that the old self can't function in the new world, and so you have to finally shed that old skin, so to speak, or cocoon, or womb, by completing a transformation. Yet obviously, Mary Hogan isn't interested in changing emotionally to accommodate Ed Gein's dead mother's needs, which means that Ed will have to do it for her physically. So if your old self sheds its skin in the darkness or womb of the unconscious mind to accommodate emotional change, then Eddie Gein will need to skin Mary Hogan and take her to the blacked-out confines of the interior of his home. Her physical change began inside Eddie's mind, not hers. So he takes her to the place that manifests his emotional world and physicality, which is his horrifying house. Now, emotional change, again, is a cleansing, a purging, so to speak, in which you remove the ugly and messy things inside you, poisoning your psyche. And when you finish, you become a different person on the inside. Eddie, of course, has no way to say that emotionally, and so what he is going to have to do again here is project his emotional world onto Mary's body. So, if Eddie is the one giving her a new identity by way of a physical cleansing instead of an emotional one, then the emotional world inside her head, meaning behind her face, after the change becomes his and not hers. Therefore, Eddie will need to cut off her face and make a mask of it so that when you see her face moving forward, like would happen with emotional change, but corrupted in physicality, she becomes a different person behind the face that you see, meaning inside her head. But rather than her emotional world residing physically behind the mask, it's Eddie's head now because he's the one who emotionally decided to make this change. From then on, with Eddie wearing her face as a mask, she will be forced to uphold the strict values instilled by Mother, as Eddie is the one then controlling her emotional world. The idea is that you see the face as a mask and instantly recognize that it really is a different person behind it. Change has truly taken place. But the horror is that someone else overtook your body, and rather than you being behind that face as an emotionally changed person, meaning born anew, it's a monster. That's who we become when we refuse emotional change. The monster overtakes us behind our mask. That's how we get Leatherface. But what we really need to see within that disgusting display is that the killer is telling us a story about how it happened to him. It happened to him emotionally, and so he is physically presenting it in symbolic imagery. And we see, of course, that Eddie's emotional world is really his mother. And so what he is doing is reversing that physicality to get revenge in the form of making Mary Hogan's emotional world his. Someone hurts you emotionally and you take revenge physically. That brings manifested balance. So on that note, he does it to others like Leatherface in the form of revenge so that they can know exactly what he suffered. There's that great moment in the 2003 Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake where Jessica Biel turns and sees Leatherface, except he's wearing her boyfriend's face. Her boyfriend was making immature decisions, such as smuggling and selling drugs, that would prevent him from becoming the father, or a man, so to speak, if he got arrested and went to prison, in a situation in which his girlfriend was secretly pregnant and hadn't yet told him due to that issue. For that reason, the film manifests her rescuing another baby, which becomes symbolic of her own. The point is that she needs to kill the man-child symbolically through emotional change to make him the father, and the man-child is the grown face of her boyfriend who got her pregnant combined with the mind of a child, or Leatherface, behind it, who refuses to mature. Leatherface simply manifests the horrific dangers of allowing a stagnant, childlike mind to accompany a grown body into its adulthood. At its core, it's a cry for help. In physicality, it says the man-child hurting other people wants us to know that behind the mask on his face you see him wearing every day is a different identity making him a monster. He causes the physical pain, suffering, and death that is taking place inside his mind because he's trying to tell you how he's being hurt emotionally. He's saying, just like the killer does to the victim in a horror movie physically outside his head, that the emotional onslaught inside cannot be stopped, cannot be killed, and will never relent no matter how many bad sequels you make because emotional problems will never have physical solutions. No matter what Ed Gein did, he never had the emotional capacity to change and become somebody else. So in order to feel what it was like and also let others symbolically understand his pain, he put himself, a different person, behind each of their faces and inside their skinned bodies. That way, they would become somebody else. On the inside, a monster. And that process would accompany physical death so that they could comprehend the emotional one Eddie suffered. Yet the saddest part is that he dressed their bodies like deer, slitting them open and removing everything that gave them life within, so we would all see that Eddie Gein was truly empty inside. That was his emotional world. He collected these faces and made so many of these masks, one after another, hoping the next one would be the perfect one. But it never was. They just kept coming. And it's because, in the same way that you and I suffer, none of those identities was really him. And if that isn't the harrowing, sad nightmare every one of us is forced to live on a daily basis in this world, I don't know what it would be instead. We collect different faces over time, various identities, trying them on for size, and soon we have more and more, a mountain of them, leaving us desperately trying to find peace behind the current one, but the only thing we can count on is that they'll change again. There will always be a new one, but never quite the right one. And so they keep coming, and we continue to hide behind them, even when everybody can easily see that it's actually somebody else. It's not really you. Ed Gein, unlike you and I, was always prevented from wearing those many changing faces emotionally as he grew, and when it was too late to go back to the past, he compensated by wearing other faces physically instead. And look what it forces the victims of such to do on a symbolic level. If Ed takes their faces, then like he felt emotionally, they won't know who they are physically. It mirrors his pain to bring balance. Emotionally, when he looks in the mirror, he doesn't know who he is behind his face, as his lack of emotional growth prevented unity between the mind of a man and the face of a man. Instead, he has the mind of a child and the face of a man. So he doesn't know who he is when he looks in the mirror. So he mirrors that fate in physicality, leaving victims with their faces removed so that symbolically you don't know who they are. The victims manifest in symbolic imagery what Ed is suffering emotionally. Anyhow, it's December 8th, 1954, and a local farmer decides to go have an afternoon drink at Mary Hogan's Tavern. He enters expecting to see Mary at work, but he's greeted by nothing but silence. There are no patrons, and no one is working, so he begins to survey the place suspiciously. That's when he notices a pool of blood on the floor, with long streaks of crimson following it. Mary doesn't respond to his calls, nor does anybody else, so he contacts the sheriff. Law enforcement arrives and discovers a spent .32 caliber round, along with the fact that the blood streaks lead from the pool where the person was shot to the parking lot outside the tavern. At that point, the blood stops. Authorities assume Mary was loaded into a vehicle. There were no leads in the case. For several years, it was suggested that something shady in Mary's past, which was somewhat dark, even by her own admission, had come back to haunt her. Somebody wanted revenge. Yet, there was still one thing that didn't sit quite right with anyone. If Mary, a burly 200-pound woman, had been executed with a bullet, shot dead right there in her tavern, as the blood and spent cartridge suggested, and there was no evidence of a struggle involving the potential for corresponding physical evidence, then why on earth would the killer go through the trouble of making a body disappear? There's nobody around. There's no struggle, there's no evidence. Why not leave her dead right there? In truth, it's obvious that a person who had no physical connection to the crime scene decided to assume one while placing a bleeding body in his vehicle. That would be a very bad move, a huge risk, unless it was necessary because your motivation had been not just murder, but to acquire the body itself. Still, they couldn't think of why anybody would be in the market for a 200-pound dead businesswoman in her 50s. It's oddly specific, to say the least, which is why they certainly wouldn't forget when it happened again. But for now, Eddie Gein was building his house of horrors in secrecy. Well, for the most part. This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Everybody knows life has its ups and downs, and when we're at the top of the mountain, having risen above adversity and feeling empowered, it's a wonderful view, but one that can often make us forget about the hard work climbing out of the valley below that got us there. For those tougher times, when we're facing the uphill challenges ahead and need some guidance, BetterHelp Online Therapy is there to assist. As someone who has benefited from therapy in the past, I've learned that BetterHelp is an affordable, flexible, and entirely online option that accommodates busy schedules. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist and switch therapists at any time for no additional charge. If you want to live a more empowered life, therapy can get you there. Visit BetterHelp.com/CCMM today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/CCMM. Eddie used to spend time with the teen son of his neighbors, the Hill family. The boy and his younger brother would come by to play cards in the kitchen, and other times they would go fishing. Eddie was just considered odd by most, harmless, an isolated bachelor and town handyman who, while a peasant, was often deemed worthy of a home-cooked meal and conversation before they sent him back to isolation. Yet, during one of those visits to Eddie's home, the younger brother, bored by the card playing, explored the home and stumbled upon multiple items that looked like shrunken human heads. They were still full size, however, and while not visible to the eye at first glance, were actually filled with paper behind the faces, giving the density of a head to what is just a mask. The brothers brushed off this discovery, with the older of the two telling his younger sibling that they were probably just props for Halloween costumes. Yet, soon after, Eddie approached another neighbor about the possibility of trading his farmhouse and land for theirs. They had very little land in relation to Eddie, so they agreed to consider it on one condition. They wanted to get a look inside the house. And Eddie was happy to oblige, with a catch. There were a couple of rooms he had closed off on the first floor. He nailed them shut, actually. Other than that, the couple was welcome to inspect the place. During their walkthrough of the decaying home, the husband suddenly came across the aforementioned masks. Eddie proudly asserted they were real shrunken heads and proceeded to spin a tale straight out of one of his adventure and fantasy magazines by mentioning that a family member fighting in the Philippines during World War II sent them back home as souvenirs. Real or not, obviously, these things did him no favors. After that, the rumors intensified, and Eddie became even more suspicious of others, choosing to take his isolation to the next level by not having any more visitors at the house. Until his arrest, he would be the only inhabitant. Nobody knew of the horrors that were taking place during this time, or perhaps it's more accurate to say that nobody seriously attributed them to Eddie. Along with the mystery surrounding Mary Hogan, there had also been various disappearances, murders, and grave robberies in the region during that stretch of the 1950s. Unbeknownst to anyone else, Eddie had also indulged a much different method of acquiring bodies, one less risky, especially in terms of potential consequences, than committing murder. Yet, Eddie's undoing would ultimately be the fact that the woman he really wanted, Bernice Warden, a local businesswoman in her 50s, was still alive. Like Mary Hogan, she was big, strong, and assertive, but while she fit the mold of a good woman in Ed's eyes and was as close to the reincarnation of his mother as he could find, the widow Bernice would never give Eddie the time of day as a romantic suitor. He asked her to go roller skating and had at other times suggested they get together, but she just rejected him. He couldn't be with her emotionally or change her emotionally, so he was going to do what he had to do in order to compensate for that physically. So when November 16, 1957, the first day of hunting season arrived, and the town was decorated in slaughtered, hanging, and recently dressed deer carcasses matching the animal Eddie had seen in the shed with his parents as a child, he was overwhelmed with a desire to kill again. He had been drawn into that dark windowless shed as a child to witness the slaughter, knowing one day it would be he and not his mother wielding the blade when he finally came into the light covered in the blood of the lamb. And when it was over, the police would find Bernice Warden hanging inside Ed Gein's house of horrors, her suspended corpse matching that of the deer. The night prior, November 15, 1957, Bernice Warden received a visit from Ed Gein at her store in town, which sold everything from hardware to farming equipment. The Geins had been customers for many years, and while Bernice knew Eddie came to do legitimate business, he also came to flirt, or at least make himself known in terms of being romantically interested. Bernice apparently didn't know if it was just a joke, as she was confused at the fact that Eddie didn't realize she found him to be a peasant. She was a respected, well-to-do businesswoman, ahead of her time in that regard, and it's in these interactions in which he's rejected by her, whether implicitly or explicitly, that he feels the sting of his mother's rejection as well. Not only did Mother refuse him physical affection like Bernice, but she also turned his father into the peasant he had become too, the meek little man. That was the point. She wanted her men to be powerless in the face of such strong women, but to desperately need them without succeeding at it because it's the suffering Augusta wanted her father to feel as revenge for abuse. She couldn't bring her father back to take revenge, so she raised a son who would, like her husband did as well, symbolically become that man and suffer the terrible fate she intended for the father who abused her. And of course, it has to be repeated because it's manifested in physicality, it's not emotional. So Augusta does it to her husband, and then she does it to Eddie. And that Eddie is going to go on and do it to others because that's how the cycle of abuse works. Now, on the evening of November 15th, before closing time at Bernice Warden's store, Eddie Gein cruised in and inquired about the price of a specific product which would set off the events leading to murder. With Bernice at the time is her adult son Frank, who took a greater role in the family business when his father passed away years earlier. Now, if Ed Gein's emotional wound driving him to commit murder is that he's stuck living in the past, frozen in time as that child still waiting for mother's love, then he will manifest a physical circumstance in which becoming unstuck or unfrozen comes by way of a woman whose affections he's been denied. Just like Eddie knew in his heart that he would only be able to move on once his mother finally showed him the love he desperately desired, when he finally projected her upon other women to cope with the reality she was never coming back, he then expected those women to submit to adoring him. But they never did. Watch how this manifests. Mary Hogan was a bartender, so Ed comes into her tavern and she serves him a beer. Alcohol gets us unstuck, or unfrozen, so to speak, on an emotional level. It can make us feel anything from a little more confident to nearly erasing the pain altogether over the short term. So when Eddie goes into that establishment and drinks, having been served the elixir by Mary Hogan, making him feel unstuck or unfrozen emotionally, he comes to believe that she has magical powers to heal him. That idea developed from the harsh reality that in the absence of his mother's love as a child, Augusta's withheld affections then became the stuff of magic, something that could miraculously and quickly heal him if he could only get his hands on it. He never did. She wouldn't surrender it. So when Mary Hogan symbolically fulfills that role of giving Eddie the thing he needs to keep him moving emotionally, meaning serving him beers, he views her as powerful in that regard, like mother, but willing. yet mother wouldn't allow him to be with a woman sexually, which is where an adult relationship between man and woman would lead. So the standard for the manner in which mother would find it acceptable for Eddie to be with another woman became the way Eddie was currently engaging his mother at home. Fair is fair, right? Mother was dead, and therefore the others would need to be as well, simply because, more than anything, he was projecting mother onto them. So as Ed Gein wanders into Bernice Warden's store on the evening of November 15th, it's just prior to the start of the hunt, both for the deer hunters and Eddie, who had plans of his own for the next day. Blood made him squeamish, you see, at least according to him. He didn't like killing deer. But Bernice was another matter. She had the elixir to get him unstuck, and here he was about to ask for it. He asks for the price of antifreeze, which is essentially symbolic code for asking, "What do I have to do to be with you and receive your love? What is that going to cost me?" And like it was with his mother and then Mary Hogan, the answer was the same with Bernice. That love was unrequited, and the only way they would ever be together would be over that woman's dead body. Eddie, with his sneaky, evil little grin, made it happen, literally. Bernice tells Eddie the price of antifreeze, and Ed says, "Great, I'll come by tomorrow with my jug to fill it." In the process, Eddie makes small talk with her son Frank, specifically asking if Frank will be out for the hunt the next morning, trying to bag a buck like everybody else in town. Frank thinks nothing of the innocent question and confirms he'll be out of work the next day. The season only went to the 24th, and the woods were crowded, so it was common for men and boys to drop everything on opening day and head out with their rifles. So Eddie thinks he's brilliant because, in one fell swoop, he learned that Frank will be out of the store the next morning and Bernice will be working alone, with all the capable men in town and their weapons far off in the woods. It's perfect. Well, except that he just told Frank he was going to come back, and behind the scenes, Frank had noted that Eddie was obviously creeping around the store trying to get close to Bernice in recent times. Again, they didn't say anything about it because the Geins had been good customers over the years. It was better to be polite. The problem is that it left Eddie believing his motivations were hidden. Yet, even though Ed Gein wasn't being too slick with his flirtations, Bernice and Frank Warden had no clue of the atrocities he'd already committed, or worse, what was to come. On the surface, Eddie was a desperate, lonely man trying to get a few words with local women by hanging around their establishments, places where they couldn't leave him or reject him because they were businesses. Yet, when he went home, he was alone again. They never came with him, and he didn't want to be alone. In truth, Eddie wanted to know what it felt like to be inside of a woman, but with his mother forbidding such things, here he was planning to make and wear a ghastly suit comprised of the skinned body of Bernice Warden so that he could both obey his mother's demand of refusing the sin of sex with a live female partner and finally know what it's like to be inside of a grown woman. He was going to hang her in the house and dress her like the deer hanging all around town. He had come full circle. After that moment in his early youth, in which he watched his mother wield the blade while dressing the carcass in the foreboding darkness of that slaughterhouse, knowing he'd do the killing one day, he's reborn as that man, the Butcher of Plainfield. Eddie Gein had a maroon 1949 Ford back then. He hopped in and made the drive to town on the morning of November 16th, stopping first to purchase something specific. Now, when we talk about the red giant, in this case, that red giant being murder, leading to a pool of blood to symbolically identify it in imagery, there is normally some type of resource involved that speaks to fuel, or more specifically, a manifested narrative that counters the idea of running out of fuel. The red giant star burns hotter and hotter, burning more and more fuel, out of control in a way that death is imminent, and death by the fate of running out of more fuel to burn. That's the emotional life of the perpetrator. In Mary's tavern, it was the beer. She kept fueling him with it. For Bernice, it's the antifreeze. So Ed gets out of his vehicle to fill his can with kerosene. Now, again, out in space, blue shifted light is newer light, or stars coming toward us, while red shifted light is older light, or stars going away. Newer or younger stars remain cooler, and by extension produce the blue shifted light, while the red shifted ones, or older ones, especially the red giants, produce the red hue, of course. So if Ed is manifesting the idea of having plenty of fuel physically, like the blue-shifted stars, instead of running out of it emotionally and burning out over time, like the red-shifted stars, then here he needs to buy kerosene because it feigns being blue-shifted light in the sense that he both fulfills the notion of having abundant fuel left and feigns that he's not really the oncoming red giant by using the standard blue can for kerosene. You put gas in a red can. You put kerosene in a blue can, even back then. So what Eddie is doing is disguising the red giant and what he really is, as he is the oncoming red giant here. He goes to the gas station and says, "No, I am not that. I am the blue-shifted star. There's something new coming." But he would be blue-shifted if this was emotional change and not physically manifested. So Eddie fills his blue kerosene can, making himself now look like the blue-shifted star in the sense that he is completely fueled and he is blue, right? So now, if a man and a star were comparable, what could we call the blue-shifted star? It's a boy. So the boy, so to speak, meaning the child still emotionally trapped inside Eddie, waiting for mother's love to set him free, is expanding down there, growing so large that he's boiled over into physical reality, where his needs can finally be accommodated in the absence of the emotional possibility. Now, the red giant is found in the abyss, or mirror universe, the place of change, and rises up from it to implement tragic fate when emotional change has been ignored for too long. So Eddie parks in front of Warden's and enters the store holding a big glass jug that's going to get filled with antifreeze. That glass jug represents the mirror universe, or abyss, in which the cleansing will take place that symbolically makes Eddie a new man, aka gets him unstuck or unfreezes him and allows him to move forward. So Bernice takes the jug into the back of the store and fills it from a steel drum of antifreeze she has and returns. So think of her serving the antifreeze just like Mary Hogan served the beer. The person in our evolutionary narrative who provides the cleansing is the Jesus character, or savior character, meaning that Bernice is playing that role here. Unfortunately for her, we all know what happens to that character. He gets sacrificed physically because others won't change emotionally. That's what Ed will do to her here. He is not capable of the emotional change required to move on from the necessity of getting mother's love, so he is going to mirror the impossibility of what he sees in his imagination into a horrifying physical reality manifested by tragic fate. Now, From the word rosebud written on the burning sled in Citizen Kane to the rosebud on the floor of Hannibal Lecter's makeshift cell when he sets himself free through murder in Silence of the Lambs, and even in the David Lewis case I covered recently, in which he went batshit crazy upon seeing a game being played at the Rose Bowl, which has a big rose at the 50-yard line, making him try to go there. The idea is that the red rose symbolizes ascension through the growth facilitated by the red giant. A red rose has a green stem representing growth, but is lined with thorns, reminding us that the pathway or ascension to love or becoming the one means that we must blossom by way of the expanding red giant. That bud opens itself from the outside in, offering the physically manifested beauty of what will become emotionally by continuing to grow, despite the pain. On the color scale, red to green, like we see with the merger of the red rosebud with green stem, is the actual abyss on the color scale, meaning the parameters of what contains the abyss. Red is all the way on the left of the color scale, and green is in the center. That is the mirror universe. It is in that place we find the red giant, or red rosebud, and so here, same goes. Watch it happen. Just like David Lewis got stuck on the bee, so to speak, and was then killed by the red giant of the Camaro, or C, that bee, or red bud, is going to come into play here. Look at the structure. Who's going to get killed? Bernice. The bee. So when it happens, what do we know will be going on? She'll be talking about another bee and in the context of red. Keep that in mind for a moment. So Eddie takes his antifreeze outside and comes back in right away to tell Bernice something. He's been thinking about making a big change. Now, in Eddie's mind, what he's about to do equates to big dick energy. As he's been stuck in the cycle of his emotional wound, this act is intended to break that cycle and send him moving forward, getting him unstuck like the antifreeze. Clearly, the only way out of the circle or the cycle is the straight line of the hunt, which obviously has phallic implications as well. Bernice sees Eddie for what he is, but he wants her to know that his straight line is going to get a lot bigger because he's going to change down in the abyss. Now, it's all manifested in corrupted physicality, simply a horrific projection of his emotional desires. So how do we bring together the idea of a growing straight line like an erection or potency, in addition to his ability to move forward very quickly in life, to change because he went to the abyss? Well, as I've often talked about, transcendent things can often be described in words beginning with M and ending with N, simply because they are the ending of the first half of the alphabet and beginning of the second, respectively, and the alphabet is consistent with the color scale. So if you were to pass that side of the color scale, meaning going from M, the first half of the alphabet, to the second half with N, what you would have done is you would have gone across green out of the abyss. So you would have gone from red all the way to the beginning to the green, and you would have crossed that out of the abyss, which means you would have been led to growth. On the color scale, green is the halfway point, or the middle. And so, in the alphabet, the space between M and N is that transcendence point. So, if you go from M to N, you grow, meaning the straight line keeps getting longer. Watch Eddie do it. He tells Bernice he's thinking of getting a new rifle because his current one only shoots rounds that are called short. Eddie explains that he wants to go from short to long, and also long rifle, taking a short line to a long one. And this is all in the context of caliber, of course, with the gun. And the caliber is the potency of the actual round. He's subconsciously using subtext to tell Bernice that she has aroused him sexually, and it foreshadows the reason he's about to do what transpires. Of course, in line with the ridiculous discourse about dick pics recently in an episode that I did, what Eddie really wants is to show her this long straight line. So he asks to see a specific and very popular brand of rifle. Remember, we need the abyss, or place of cleansing, the straight line causing pain, and then also the idea of ascension resulting from what this purchase will make him become. In that light, the rifle is a marlin, just like the creature from the ocean. Why the marlin, aside from the M to N implications of transcendence? Well, the marlin moves underwater through the ocean, or abyss of change, with outrageous speeds unmatched by most living things in its environment, finally running down its prey and shredding and stabbing it with a long, straight, and sharp snout that manifests the idea of an erection. The marlin is known for jumping or ascending from the abyss, with that long straight line of the snout or spike leading the way. The problem really is in Eddie's head, however, so he's manifesting a creature that has a massive erection coming from its head instead. Now, as Bernice turns around, what he does, as you do when you're going to fire a rifle, is place the long, straight erection, like the marlin had, but here with the rifle, on his own face as he lifts the rifle and points it at her. Now he has the snout. Now he has that erection extending from his brain, just like the marlin, and he is going to use it to kill. But again, instead of the straight line of creation, it's the straight line of death, like the marlin offers. He and the marlin are both simply manifesting a physical ascension out of the abyss because they can't otherwise escape. The marlin cannot evolve to leave the ocean as we did, and Ed can't evolve past the psychological limitations of his own evolution in the human abyss of childhood. So here, Ed puts the marlin rifle up to his face, just like the snout, so that he can take aim at his prey, and the truth is there for us to see. He reaches in his pocket, and what does he use to kill her physically? It's the thing that killed him emotionally. It's a short round, symbolizing the short straight line he could never trade in for the long one, or the rifle long, making him more powerful or potent. And we see that that trade-in never actually happens. He and Bernice never actually do that business because he's incapable of it. He knew the truth. So to get revenge, he loads his .22 short round into the marlin rifle and takes aim, moving so swiftly that his unsuspecting prey never sees it coming. And why? Her back is turned. She's looking at something. A Chevy. There's our C, which means the redundant or repetitive B's are next. It's structural. The repetitive B's are always in the hunt. This will be our red rosebud. Suffering leading to growth. But instead of sacrificing himself emotionally, Ed is going to kill Bernice physically. Okay, so let's break this down to make it more easily understood. The logic quadrant in which our physical reality operates parallels what we know as the coordinate plane. Those four quadrants within the coordinate plane, in reverse order, because we evolved through reverse engineering back to the beginning in the infinite loop, are D, C, B, A, respectively. The movement from B to A is the transcendence to the alpha, or the one, and so there can't be any repetition within that framework. Therefore, if you fail to transcend, as we see here with Ed unable to become the father, so to speak, and with David Lewis losing his mind, compromising his role as the father, you get stuck on the B in the logic quadrant. It just keeps repeating. David Lewis lost his shit when he looked at the TV screen and saw Buffalo Bills, the redundant bees, going across the screen in front of the red rosebud on the 50-yard line, and he rushed to get there. Then he got a stack of money, specifically bills, the redundant bees, and kept separating them over and over, according to a cab driver, like he just kept counting them for no reason. Again, he was trying to separate the bees. He's trying to kill the bees, so to speak, which is exactly what Ed will do here. Now, again, if we're thinking about the redundant bees, what's going on out in the woods while Ed is doing this? What are these hunters trying to make redundant? The bees, the bucks, that's what they're doing. And so that's going on here in the same way that it does in the David Lewis case and everywhere else. And again, in the Silence of the Lambs, when the rosebud appears, it happens right after a discussion about what specifically? The killer, whose name is Buffalo Bill, the redundant bees. Once Hannibal Lecter, a cannibal, kills the cops and sets himself free from his cell, manifesting the idea of setting himself free from what's consuming him emotionally, his physical act to compensate only yields a transcendence physically, of course. There's no emotional change regarding what's consuming him emotionally. So to show that he only went from B to A or beta to alpha in that context, the camera pans across a copy of the magazine Bon Appetit, giving us B to A in the context of physical consumption rather than emotional. So here, Eddie shows up in a Ford. The fourth quadrant is D. That's our D, 4D. That's how you actually get the word Ford. Now, the subject at hand is a car across the street, Ford's biggest rival, then and now, a Chevy, which isn't coincidental. It's structural. If you recall, the vehicle David Lewis drove was also a Ford, and when he encountered the Chevy, or Camaro, he ended up dead. Same goes here. It's all structural. Bernice comments, in ignorance of what's going on behind her, that she doesn't like the new red Chevy parked across the street. The one that belongs to a man named what? Bud. Giving us redundant bees with Bernice and Bud, along with the red rose or red bud distinction, meaning this is the moment she's going to get blown away. Right then, Eddie blasts Bernice, eliminating the redundant bee and manifesting the idea of growth through the blossoming red bud, red giant. But again, because it's manifested just like it is at the Rose Bowl, it's on the ground, just like it is in Lecter's cell. It's on the ground. There is no ascension. These roses are found on the ground. And so here she falls and we have a pool of blood on the ground. So that becomes our red bud. The blood explodes right at the moment she says bud. These redundant bees, just like the bills and the bucks, are the ones that I talk about regularly. You can only become the A or alpha by eliminating the beta or redundant bees, and so to symbolize that merger of the universe and mirror universe, or physical reality with emotional world, to become one, or the one, the alpha, Eddie fires a 22 round that manifests the 1-1 of the emotional world and also 1-1 of the physical reality, with neither having merged to become one emotionally. So instead, he has to use the bullet to substitute as the one it becomes. Yet, when he does that, look at the hilarious irony that ensues. What is the bullet? A bee. He just created another bee. It's the bee. It reminds you emotional change never occurred, and so neither did transcendence. It was only physical change in the form of death. And so instead of getting the red rose actually rising, we find the red blossoming on the floor, just like it does in Lecter's cell, like it does in the Rose Bowl. And so in this moment, again, as Bernice lies there, instead of a blossoming red rosebud rising in growth and life, she has fallen and died, leaving an expanding pool of blood in place of the red rosebud. This red giant led to death, not growth, and simply because the means by which it was facilitated were only physical. So Eddie used Bernice's work truck to haul her body home, and then came back to get the car. Once he had the body inside the house, he knew what he had to do. What he didn't know, however, is that he would soon have visitors. Lots of them. And eventually, Eddie Gein's secrets would all be known. But in the meantime, Frank Warden returns from the hunt empty-handed and enters the store to realize Bernice is missing. He spots a sticky, drying substance on the floor, something dark red, and realizes it's blood. He calls out for Bernice, but there's no response. And then it hits him. Somebody shot Bernice, dragged her out the door, and took her away in a truck. Just like Mary Hogan. Frank wondered to himself, who would do this? And in the chaos of those thoughts, one name kept popping into his mind, and only one. He surveyed the counter where Bernice had been working, and that's when he saw it. A sales receipt she had written for some antifreeze. Frank scoured the paper to find the buyer's name. And there it was. Ed Gein.